The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, Bill King is with us today. I love it when Bill King gets on. His brain operates like a pinball machine that's just going crazy. It's like you're getting bonus points here, bonus points there. But what he says is really very concise in what he's wrapping the world up into just a few statements. And I want to hear what he has to say about quantitative easing, because it looks like they're not going to be able to quantitatively ease.
We have an economy that is a wreck, and we've been able to paper over that with a variety of tools issued from the Treasury and the Fed. And the perception in the marketplace today is that things are getting better, we're in recovery, and the shock will be for the vast majority of people that it could not be farther from the truth.
Right.
We are in a deteriorating economic and market situation, and just because you see higher prices, that does not mean that what you have supporting you is anything of a sustainable nature. So I think it's important not only to look at things from a market technical perspective, but also from a broad economic perspective. Not to harp just on fundamentals, but, you know, there is a combination of what is in play, what does Wall Street see, what are the titans of Wall Street doing with their own money, in contrast to what they're telling others to do, by the way. And what do we see, again, from an economic standpoint? Like Vallejo, California, we're broke. We know that. Everyone knows that. What are we doing about it? And that's what we have. The political sphere is not doing anything, which leads us to one thing.
You bring up the politics. I mean, Bill King has used the same cycle that you've talked about for many years, the financial transferring to the economic, to the political, then the geopolitical.
Well, Bill, it's great to have you back on the program with us. And, you know, when we look at the economy, we know that economic growth relies on growth in the labor force. Haven't had much of that. In fact, growth has been in decline for some time. Increases in income, another source of economic growth, and we actually don't really have good news on that side either. But the third variable that can drive economic growth is credit growth. Where are we going to get our growth moving into 2014 and 2015?
Well, that's the question everybody's searching around for. Is, you know, who's going to be the golden goose here? And it's not just here, it's globally. You know, part of this whole rally in the first part of this year is because of the Abenomics. And, you know, that Japan was going to print their way out. Yeah, like, that's a novel concept, right? We're going to print our way out of an economic problem. And it's not working. It's just not working. And you know, that's a separate issue to talk about later. But, then, you know, then it was, well, Europe's going to get better. Well, you know, how's it going to get better? On what basis? Because they're going to raise taxes in France? Because they're going to create more, you know, social nets? You know, the big picture, and I think we mentioned this, you know, months ago, it's because it's been going for years, is the collapse of the Western welfare states. And that includes Japan, which is their model. It's collapsing. And that's the problem everybody's facing here, is that because of the ascent of China and other developing nations, it has accelerated the declining living standards in the West that have been going on for decades. That massive transfer of wealth to the BRIC countries and other developing nations has just devastated Western and Japanese economies. Of course, where it got worse was with the 2008 crisis, because the governments went all-out Keynesian and monetarist to save their big banks. And in the process, they've bankrupted themselves further. So the big banks, as we see, whether it's Europe, whether it's the U.S., the big banks are joined at the hip with the sovereigns. And that's the problem now, because everybody recognizes they're pushing up to thresholds on debt that are unsustainable. And that is what we've done. We stopped the global depression two ways, by having this enormous QE that is global. It's Japan, it was China, it's Europe, the ECB, the U.S. You can go through the list, which is unprecedented in, you know, human history. And the second thing they did is they fired up the Keynesian engine by creating all these bailout programs, by TARP, by all the entitlements, which we see in the United States, whether it's food stamps, disability, you name it, they're just going berserk to the upside. But in the process, you know, you're killing these sovereign governments. They're running out of room to do things, running out of maneuverability. And there's no light. You know, the whole, however many decades, six, seven, eight decades of this thought that the government can always create demand, you know, the Keynesian, with demand soft, government will make up for it. The problem is, for 8 years, government has increasing share of the economy. You know, the original Keynesian concept, you could argue, is true, that, okay, when demand falls, government jumps in. But it's implicit that when demand picks up, the government should jump out. That has not happened. The government just kept getting more and more voracious, more rapacious, just taking over more and more of the economy. And in the process now, it's being bankrupting nations. So now you have this problem here where you need organic growth, but you can't get it because most economic growth comes from small companies. They're the innovators. They're the people that hire. They don't manage for cash flow. They manage because they have ideas. They have vision. And that is being destroyed by politics and other factors in here. And that is, you know, you saw an article in The Economist magazine a week or two ago said this precisely, that for decades, the economic studies show that small business creates 70% of the job growth. And in the 80s and the 90s and whatever here, it was even more than that because the big companies were all downsizing. Downsizing, growing global. That was the big thing in the 80s. Downsizing because they didn't want to get the corporate raiders like Icon to come in and greenmail them. So they downsized. And then as we moved into the 90s, what we had was this technology boom in the internet where people started replacing labor, especially in manufacturing, with technology. But the good news was you still had this nascent internet was creating more and more jobs. Now, what's happened over the last 10, 12 years is we're at the point of the technology cycle where technology destroys more jobs than it creates. The point being in the 90s is you were destroying manufacturing jobs. You were destroying jobs with people in publishing, in printing, in typing. You know, you could list mail delivery. You just list all the things that technology was taking over, research, on. But you were creating jobs as these economies and the internet and all the ancillary services and products were expanding. Now we're at the point where you have all these technological efficiencies and wonders in the market, but you're not creating new technology. What has Apple created new? Well, they've improved the iPhone. There's no groundbreaking new technology devices or software. So consequently, it still goes through the marketplace. It kills jobs in other industries, but the technology industry is not creating new jobs. And that's clear when you look at any of the data, whether it's the BLS or other foreign countries, is technology and information jobs have been declining for a number of years now. And where's the job growth? The cheap, easy, the low-paying gigs, retail, leisure, healthcare, you can go through it, business services, temps, on. And of course, with the Obamacare, that's a factor. Tax hikes this year, that's a factor. So unless you can find a magic lamp with a genie or the golden goose, you know, good luck in trying to find organic growth somewhere because it's just not happening.
It looks like the Fed's strategy has been to create a wealth effect. You put QE in place and push up the stock market, push up real estate, and get people spending so that there is job creation. And, you know, so that's the strategy. QE has pushed up the stock market. The question is, would more QE do the same? Are there limits?
Yeah, more QE will push up stocks. There's no question. But what they're confronted with now, and it's actually, in the media hit it, was the Jackson Hole in August. There were three academic research pieces that said, you guys are wrong. This wealth effect is not working. But that's all they have. I mean, you're right. Everything is based on the wealth effect and the QE, and it's not working. It's enriching somewhere between, you know, 1% or 0.5% of the population. It's just not helping. And in the meantime, as I wrote recently, you're deflating everybody's income. You're taking anybody that has a bank account, money market, a bond, a CD, and you've taken their income and given it to the big banks and to people that have big positions in the stock market. And that kills people. Because the average person wants a steady, reliable stream of income, of interest income. And the retirees, you want them dependent on the stock market? They're not going to be. They're just not. You want to know. You don't want to dip into your capital. You want to have that string of income that you know is right, and you've destroyed it. You've crushed it. And you force these people to do two things, speculate or go take night jobs at Walmart. And that's what they've done to people. Go to grocery stores. Go to stores where you used to see high school people or young adults manning cash registers or sweeping floors or being customer service rep. Now, and the data is very clear, it's people from 55 to 75 are taking those jobs. The only demographic of job growth over the last year or so is 55 to 64 and 65 to 74. I think that's the brackets that the BLS use. That's the only people showing job growth. There's a reason, because people cannot retire, because you've killed their interest income, you've killed the pensions, and it's very deflationary. You know, people think QE is inflationary. No. That's one of the reasons Japan has not gotten out of their hole. It was a nation of savers, and you killed their investment and interest income. You're doing the same thing in the U.S. Who benefits? You know, less than 1%. And the idiots at the Fed can't see that they're producing deflation. because you're killing income. The U.S. economy is the consumer. The U.S. consumer is their income and their household liquidity, meaning what your jobs and your income produce, plus what you have saved up that you get in income, especially for retirees or people that are working part-time or are semi-retired. You know, you have a nice income stream coming in, so you take a part-time job. Now it's the opposite, is you're just getting crushed, so you want to be retired, but you take a part-time job. And it's all because of the Fed. But they cannot admit that they're wrong because it's their life's work. It's decades of saying this was going to work, even though there's no evidence it ever has worked. And in fact, the evidence is Japan is making their deflation worse. And that's the other thing I want to talk about. Is that, and I've mentioned this for years, that when the QE doesn't work, just like in the 30s when the Fed pumped money like crazy, when you point that out to people, they go, well, they didn't do enough. Just like Japan. Well, Japan's been, you know, doing, they went to zero interest rate policy in April of 1995. How's that working out? Well, they didn't do enough. And that was Bernanke. Well, they didn't do enough. They should have done quantitative easing. Well, they did do that. Well, they didn't do enough. So that's what Abe, that's what Abenomics is. Abe's going, you know what? We're going to do enough. We're going to do mind-boggling amount. And that's not working out for them. And that's what's scaring the Fed now. Because the QE, you know, the people have missed the real story here. It's all been, well, they're not going to taper QE because the economy's soft. Wait a minute. You guys are missing it. That at the end of last year, at the Jackson Hole, the Fed said, we're going to do QE3. And then a couple months later, was it December? They said, we're going to do QE infinity. And then you had the Abenomics. And the global economy's not responding. In fact, it's rolling over in the U.S. So what if you don't taper? You're still, this is like, you know what, we're giving you these drugs. We think you're going to get better, so we're going to take the drugs away. Oh, you know what, you're getting worse, so we're not going to take the drugs away. That's good news. The drugs aren't working. So now you got a problem with the Fed is it's not working. We know it's not working, and the model doesn't work. And then you're seeing the academics saying just what you're saying. Your wealth effect model doesn't work. It's busted. And so now if the Fed goes, what does the Fed do? Okay, we won't taper. But if the economy rolls over as it is, what do? You're going to do more? Why? Your model doesn't work. So now you got to find a model that works. There's no evidence that this works. How much would be enough? How much QE would be enough? Just, and this is the point you were making, is can they do more? Sure, they can do more, but will it work? And again, you normally would go to your model and say, you know, that's what Bernanke came up with when they said, why are you doing $600 billion of QE the first time? He goes, well, we equate that to 50 basis point rate cut. So what are you going to do this time? What, you know, you're doing $85 billion a month. It's almost, you know, trillion a year. What are you going to do, $2 trillion a year? And they understand you reach the threshold where you bubble the stock market, where you bubble select real estate markets, and then it all crashes, because they always do crash. It's unsustainable. You create bigger problems, and then you can't print your way out of that. So it's a very difficult environment. It's difficult for everybody to navigate. The problem is we've got academics running the Fed instead of bankers. You know, this has been my thing for a long time, is that we're not letting academics. This is like, you know, your Houston Astros down there. You know what? There's been so bad. We're going to go get a bunch of academics to come in and run the team, and they'll give us all their theories. That's not what you would do. You find good baseball people and you bring them in. You know, you try to steal front office from St. Louis Cardinals or somebody. But that's the problem with our Fed. We have academics that have little or no banking experience or real experience. Volcker was the last banker that had real experience. And they've, with the academics have stolen the Fed, and they're trying out theories. You know, good luck with that. And that's another problem we're having here.
Yeah, we look at the market. We've got momentum to the upside. That's the current picture in equities. What do you see happening now? I mean, we have sort of a constructive picture according to the media.
Yeah.
But arguably risks are multiplying.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see?
The risks are going through the roof. That's why the volume is collapsing. That's why Carl Icahn sold out half of his Netflix. That's why he's on Twitter yesterday and today, while he's out on CNBC pounding Apple. He's trying to get Apple to take him out. He's clear. He wants Cook to buy his position. Well, why? You didn't see him do that with Netflix, did you? You just let the market work. But that's what these people don't understand. When you see these activist investors, as they're called, whether it's the hedge funds, when they go public and they're tweeting, and Bill Gross, when they're talking their book, they're nervous. They want somebody to take them out because the market's not taking them out the way they want it to be taken out. So they're trying to create something. But the volume's not here. Anybody that works in this industry and sits here every day and has clients, the volume is horrible. And it's mostly, even though on top of that, it's mostly high-frequency trading, hedge funds, and professional traders. The institutions are just sitting around. Now, I know you had a very insightful conversation with some top money managers who are having outstanding, just ridiculous performance because they've been in the right stocks and the right groups and are going berserk. And what they're doing is they're trying to tell their clients, hey, look, guys, We are so far above norms of performance. We know this can't continue. In fact, Bill Miller just did this recently, right? He came out and said, hey, you know, I've done so well in this last 4 or 5 years. I'm not going to do this in the future. You just can't do it. But what is alarming then is, with this unbelievable performance over the last couple, 3 years, virtually all their asset growth is coming from the stock's appreciation, which means they're not getting new money in. Normally, as you know, when you perform well, money comes after you very hard. It's not happening now because it's not there. You know, the big pensions are being squeezed in the states. The individual people aren't putting money in as much into the... In fact, they're depleting their 401ks and IRAs and pensions. And that's a dynamic that the street doesn't want to talk about. That even the people with great performance are having difficulty getting money coming into them. That's why the volume's abysmal. That's why you see these layoffs are starting to show up more and more on Wall Street. You know, a lot of it's the mortgage and the refi area. But that still has an effect going through the trading desk and everything else, the mortgage trading, the bond trading, et cetera. And nobody trusts the markets. It's all the Fed. It's centrally planned markets. And that's one of the, another way Bernanke is killing employment is with centrally planned markets. You get people leave the industry. And the you got stocks at all-time highs. The street is angry. It's upset. Nobody's happy. You've got volume going down, and people understand that this whole game here is the economy's getting bad, buy stocks because we're going to keep doing QE or increase it. That's extremely, extremely dangerous environment.
We look at the markets from a monetary backdrop, talking about volume brings in a bit of the structure of the market. Maybe you can speak a little more to the technical backdrop that you see.
Yeah, you know, we wrote up recently, we're doing one of these ascending wedges, which used to be a rare pattern, but we've done it a lot over the last 3-4 years. And of course, what that is you go up and down. And as you're going up and down on an upward sloping bias, is the pullbacks are getting narrower and narrower. So that wedge, you know, on the left-hand side is quite large, and then it keeps narrowing down. Now, as you're getting more current in history, and of course, why this is dangerous is one of two things happens. You break the bottom band, the bottom, which is the support trend line, and you usually get a hellacious collapse. You can Google rising wedge. There's a lot of charts showing that.
And you'll see this most clearly if you're looking at the S&P 500 for the last 12 to 18 months, that kind of a time frame.
Right.
This is the chart pattern that you're seeing in that, in that the S&P 500.
Exactly. And it takes a while. And what is happening is you're getting, part of the psychology is people are getting more and more bullish, and they're buying dips more and more. Now, the other thing that tends to happen in this is you have decreasing value. Now, you tend to break down and break down severely. However, one of the other things that occurs is you break out to the upside above the upper trend line, and you tend to go parabolic. That's why this is a dangerous formation, is that there's normally a very volatile move coming up or down. And what you're trying to do now, the stocks have got to rally robustly here. You know, we wrote here is you got to break the surly bands of market gravity here to get this thing going parabolic. You know, what they're trying to do is the traders are trying to do what they do to stocks like Google and Tesla. You know, the trading sardines, what they had done to Netflix is just push these things straight up and just jam all the shorts and run them up there. And then, of course, what happens, just like Tesla or Netflix, you know, some event shows up and they just get cratered. You know, like Netflix trades up to 389 on great earnings. The next thing in the aftermarket's trading 314 because Icahn sold half of his 6 million share stake. You know, Tesla, same thing, going berserk, and then they have a little problem here with, you know, with the battery thing or the fire, whatever it is. And that's where you're at. It's a very, very dangerous background for structure of the market. I mean, that's what's going on. You saw in Japan. You know, Japan went straight up on the Abenomics, and then it just went straight down. Boom. And that's what we're doing here with the markets, because the traders come in, they race it, they push it. They're not doing, there's no value investing here. This is market impact. This is momentum. This is the algos, which are just programmed to do this without thinking. They see a headline, weak economy by stocks, you know, by gold. And it goes boom, and they do it without thinking until it starts blowing up. Then somebody will reprogram that algorithm. And that's why, again, this is dangerous. You know, as I wrote here, is in 1987, we had the mindless computer type investing in program trading and portfolio insurance. And it put, at that time, it was about 22% rally of 500 points in the Dow, all based on these shenanigans. And then when the computers went the other way, we had the 1987 crash. That's a tea party compared to what's going on now. It's not even close.
Bill, you mentioned market impact.
Right. What we have now is just so much faster and more devastating. you know, the reason a market didn't crater further in 87 was you couldn't talk to your broker. You couldn't enter orders. You know, as I tell people all the time, because I was sitting there, I was there when this was happening, is that even though the you know, they showed that screen, this Dow Jones down 508, that's not the truth. The problem was where the futures, S&P futures and the OEX options were trading, you should have been down another 50%. And if your screen would have been saying down 750, it wouldn't have said down 750. It would have been down 2,000. Because at that point, everybody's busted everywhere. The market was inefficient enough that things weren't in line. I'm telling you from firsthand experience, you couldn't enter orders. You couldn't get brokers to pick up your phone call. Whether you're calling the New York Stock Exchange floor or people were calling your stockbrokers, you couldn't contact your mutual fund. There was a safety net built in was communication inefficiencies and technology inefficiencies. Now, how many people can zip their own account do transactions? You couldn't do that in 87.
So today we have circuit breakers and the potential for firms to step in and cancel trades. You know, I mean, let's say you are actually short the market, benefit, and they can cancel the trade, or you have a buy order in at a low price and you buy the shares, but the trade can still be canceled. I mean, there is a sense in which there's more than just the bond market, which is a rigged game today. When you look at Wall Street and the way the equity markets trade, you have to know that there's rules that can change in the middle of play. And how do you address that?
Well, you can't, because they this is the market structure they gave you. So almost daily we see individual stocks crash because all of a sudden there's a bunch of orders in there. You can imagine what happens when there's a bunch of real institutional sellers. The problem is, and we see this when we trade. We have one big institution comes in, and we know we're getting a program, and that means they're giving out others. They'll change, just that one guy will change the whole flow of the market until they're done. And that's just one, because there's so many algos out there, and they're looking for a disturbance in the market. And all of a sudden, they see an abnormal amount of buy or sell orders, whatever side the program's on, and they immediately go into that mode. They start buying S&P futures or ETFs or the industry that they start seeing the disturbance. You can imagine what's going to happen if a half dozen, eight, ten major institutions decide that they need to sell stocks. Those algos are going to just go berserk, and you're not going to be able to hide it. And that's, again, 87 had the circuit breakers were the inefficiencies in communication technology. Now, we're light years more efficient in communication and technology and order, right, in order delivery systems so that you can do things in nanoseconds, and God help you. And there's no specialist now. You know, specialists in the past would stop trading, they would buy, they would sell, they would hold things. You don't have that anymore. It's just computers talking to computers for the most part now.
So what do you do preserving wealth today? What does that require?
What it requires for you is to vigilantly look at your portfolio, make sure you have a well, I hate to say diversified, because that's not quite, you know, well diversified means a nice basket of stocks. I don't mean that. I mean asset class diversification with a healthy cash hoard somewhere. Depending on what your circumstances are. I mean, that's the problem. You can't just give out general information because it depends on what your income stream is, depends on what your asset stream. You own property. You own how many? Is it rental? Is it vacation? Is it primary residence? So effectively what you need here is you need a cash reserve. And on the other side, what the whole world is in search for is a vehicle that will preserve the purchasing power of your cash because of all the QE and all the government problems that are going on in the world. So that's what you're looking at here. And I know some of these big, important people. Look at Warren Buffett. He's got a record amount of cash. Whatever, what is it, $58 billion or whatever? There's a reason he's doing that, because he's not comfortable with what's going on. But you can look at a lot of other big billionaire-type people. They have a nice reserve of cash. They have some gold. They'll have some real estate. They'll have some art. You know, that whole kind of mix of some diamonds, whatever
real
it
stuff.
Is. And that way it's like, you know what? What people don't want to get caught with is things can move very quickly right now and you can't move. So that's why you see so many people have large amounts of cash now, because they recognize that developments and news can occur so quickly now that you don't have time to move. So that's why I just keep recommending, if you got portfolios and holdings, you got to look at them and make sure that you've weeded out any possible problems. You're as low on debt as you can be. You've got a nice cash reserve. And you have a hedge on your purchasing power. The whole world's looking for a medium of exchange that's reliable. Because, you know, there's so much currency debasement going on. That's why stocks have played up. Now, what is interesting to me, and you know it's because it's in the letter, and I'll be highlighting it tomorrow, is because of what is happening now where you're getting economic weakness and there's not going to be a tapering, and some people are trying to make the case that you should do more liquidity, that gold is all of a sudden trading in concert with stocks. Now, we all know in February, commodities fell apart. Part of that was China stopping the commodity financing. There was other things going on, you know, the higher taxes in the U.S., the amount of money that came in at the end of 2012 to beat the tax hikes, you got a lower budget deficit. So there were a lot of things here that India tried to stop the inflow of gold into their country. They were worried about a bubble. There's a lot of things going on that wrecked not only gold, but commodities. You saw copper, all these things peaked mid-February, and then they just went to hell. And you know, the thought also was the tapering. But now that's off the table here. And of course, in China was also tightening, if you remember back then. They were tightening to try to stop the property bubble, et cetera. So you had this huge whack in gold in here, and stocks recovered more quickly, and they went up. But now if you're watching just like today, because you had soft U.S. economic data, principally the market PMI was much softer than expected, as was the EU. Services and manufacturing were softer than expected. So that's why we're up, and gold is up, and copper's down. Because, oh, God, the economy's weak, you know, more QE, or at least they're not going to taper QE, so... You know, it's a knee-jerk algorithmic reaction. But that, I think, is very important now, is gold is trading in concert with stocks. In fact, and you see it with the gold, stocks also are getting bids. So now we might get back to where we were a couple of years ago, where gold and gold stocks would outperform the S&P 500 and the Russell 2000, because we're at a point here where there's going to be no or little economic, real economic growth. And you might play the funny money longer than people expected. So there's a market adjustment going on here.
You know, just in a few weeks, mid-November, same time frame I'll see up in Chicago, we've got China's third plenum Congress, and it's a very good time for them to lay out a clear path towards economic rebalancing. It happened in 74, I think it happened, or 78 rather, I think it happened again in 84, where the third plenum was a big deal. You roll out the implementation strategy, just not like the five-year plan, but now let's get into the nitty-gritty of how we're going to get this done. We know that rebalancing in China is treasury negative. I mean, in large part because they are moving away from their tradable goods sector, and, you know, less deficits here mean less surpluses there, mean less need to be buying treasuries in the first place. How do we then finance our deficits? That's a part of the question.
Well, that's what the QE is. The QE, there's only a handful of beneficiaries. With the big banks, as you can see what's happened with their earnings and the reserves that they've piled up in there. The second is government. You know, we did QE during World War II to finance what was uncontrollable spending. That's what's going on now. The biggest beneficiary of QE is the federal government, because they're paying very little in interest. If you went to regular market rates, they couldn't service the debt. And that's what has happened. You know, Japan quit buying, 2005, 2006, and that's when the Chinese accelerated their buying. And now the Chinese have stopped. As you can see with the tick flows in that, they're weaker than expected, just what you're saying. But who stepped into that? The Fed. The Fed balance sheet, it's ridiculous. It's going to be $4 trillion by the end of the year.
They can continue to do QE and cover over issues in the Treasury market for some time. Is the canary really the U.S. dollar on the cusp of breaking technical support right now?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know, and as you know, that's what we warned here the last couple weeks, is get your dollar chart out. It's in collapse. And it's right near the low that we had in February. And if you remember, that was the peak in the commodities this year. And then they all went to hell in the middle of February. And that was because the tapering talk in China, et cetera, was going on. The dollar strengthened. If you start taking these lows out, you got a little room, but then you start taking out 2011 low. You can look at the chart. You got a real problem developing here. And then you got a new, and part of this is Janet Yellen coming in. Everybody expects her to be, you know, an uber dove, maybe even more so than Bernanke. And she's going to have a real problem when she comes in here, because she comes in and the expectation is, it's like a teacher coming in and you go, God, the substitute teacher, we know who she is. She's really easy. We can railroad her. Now she's going to be made principal. And so everybody's thinking how they're going to abuse this person. But that's what is going on here. And she's going to have a very interesting start. If she rolls over like they thought, then she'll never get in front of the market. The market will never respect her unless she goes Volcker on them. And then we know that happens, it's Armageddon. So to me, I'm looking to see, I think she's going to come in and have to do something very tough-minded in the beginning, or to disabuse the market that she's this easy pushover. And we can, we'll keep playing the financial terrorism card and she'll keep accommodating us. Or if she doesn't, you're right, the dollar's going to go to hell. And the one thing anybody was around in the 70s realized, when you had those squishy Fed CEOs, They never got ahead of the curve. They always, well, we'll hike rates 25, another 25. And because you're behind the curve, you just make things worse. Now, Volcker came in and said, I know how to stop this. Watch this. No, I'm just taking, I don't care where rates go. I'm not raising rates. I'm just slowing the growth of the reserves down. The rates are going to go where they're going to go. And he did it. So it's going to be interesting to see how she comes in. Because she comes in the wrong way. Again, just think of some substitute teacher who has a real squishy reputation. You're making her the dean of discipline or the principal. And everybody's expecting that we're going to just roll her as we want. She's going to have a problem here when she comes in. And right in the very beginning of her term. It's going to be real interesting.
We had a similar conversation to this back in mid-2008. And there was probably more concern in your tone and in the content of our conversation than I had heard and read in your report in a long time. It's a challenging circumstance when, cash hoard is attractive, and yet the cash hoard may go through the meat grinder and be turned into some sort of sausage. But that's a better alternative than being long the equity market 100%. So this cash hoard with the world still looking for a reliable medium of exchange, it seems like you could simplify and just say, okay, well, don't call this genius, but if you had a third of your assets in gold, a third of your assets in stocks, a third of your assets in cash, and then you just get down on your knees and pray.
Well, something similar, that whole mix of stocks and gold, I think you should have some type of gold in there, because some of the very smart people, some of the captains of industry that I know have that position, some gold, but they also have diamonds, they have art, a store of value. So what I'm saying is they have a diversified portfolio, but it's not what you would think where Wall Street would sit you down with their wealth manager and goes, okay, here, and that's how these guys, almost all these guys now have a computer program that the firm hands out to them because they don't want to be sued. And it's like, here, based on your circumstances, you should have this amount in stock fund, and then they'll even break that down into emerging market, growth, value, and then this amount in bonds, and they'll subdivide that, maybe, some percent commodities and some percent cash. But what the other people doing is, it's really, the question really now is, because people don't want to hold bonds here, long-term bonds. They might hold something short as a diversification, a year or two. They're basically a substitute for cash. But basically, it's cash, and what is my hedge against that? And again, it could be, whatever. The wealthier you are, the more you have a propensity to buy diamonds.
Well, the other thing about real things is that it's quiet wealth.
Yeah, it is. But, you're at this point, a lot of people aren't really trying to make money at this point. Those that have the money are trying to preserve it because they don't see the opportunities. That's why you see share buybacks and all this other, is that you see Icahn fooling around here, forcing people to buy by taking positions, using the social media and the media to push it up and then unload that stuff. Now, he's not here restructuring companies or creating jobs or creating new industries. That's kind of the deal here. He's just kind of having, he sees a chance to make money in that, but where's he preserving his money? And that's globally, is where do you hide? And again, I go back to you better be liquid, you better be able to meet your obligations, but you better have some real asset hedge in here against your cash. And the key question, not too long ago, I sat down with one of the biggest names in private equity, everybody knows, a name very recognizable, and the question is, well, who wins, inflation or deflation? And I said, well, I don't know, I think we get both. And he was, that's kind of how it looks, and that's the fight. You got systemic deflation, and you got government central bank trying to inflate our way out. And that's why you don't know who's going to win this thing right now. So you better be able to go quickly when it goes, but you also better be in a position that when it does start happening, you're not going to get wiped out. And along those lines, the problem isn't owning businesses right now. In fact, a good business that is going to generate cash, no matter what happens, is a great investment. The problem is, as you mentioned, is the stock market is, because of this, people are looking for this, they've grossly overvalued companies that have that propensity. So, I know some very smart guys, and what they're doing is they're buying individual, auto body shops, because that's going to be here no matter what happens. So on a micro level, on a smaller level, and on a bigger level, I see people buying, the Walgreens, the CVS. These guys, no matter what happens, you get inflation, they're going to be here. You get deflation, they're going to be here. And they're going to generate cash. Certainly industrial type of companies that have products. I think one of the reasons the state of Texas is doing so well is because of the energy. Certain parts in Canada, in your area, and that we have energy. Even though when you look up and you see, oil isn't really doing anything. In fact, it's kind of going down. But you see investment, you see growth, you see things happening, you see jobs, you see people investing money, you know, that type of situation in here. And that's kind of what the big picture play is. The stock market is really a sucker's game right now. It's professionals, it's algos, it's people that have to play this, the money managers that have to meet their benchmarks and have to do these things. And that, again, the proof, and I'm not, you know, there's a lot of people make opinions, but the proof is in the volume and also that the best performing money managers are not able to attract money right now because it's just not there.
Well, something you mentioned earlier, government has an increasing share of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
We have government that's attempting to manage the economy as a whole via the Fed, the Treasury, maybe a few Wall Street pimps throwing in their two bits.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, do we assume a further slide towards a command economy? We went through that in the 1940s and really didn't emerge with an all-clear signal until about 1949. The market basically protested, you're right, if you had a private business and it had cash flow generation, you just continued to either find comparable businesses and buy them or sit on cash. Can we assume that there will be constructive change over a series of election cycles? Or in your opinion, is this the point where you have to go the full cycle? Collapse of Western welfare state includes the desperate attempts to prop up the system. Maybe that's healthcare. Maybe that's everything coming under one roof in terms of control and influence. Is there a way out, or are we sort of on an inevitable track?
Great question. I mean, that is the question. And it's very clear. Everybody with half a brain, and it's, again, this reflected in all the polling, knows the country is on the worst path. It's reflected in the opinions of the politicians and business and Wall Street, whatever. It's on an unsustainable path. We all know that. The debt is unsustainable. The problem is, and again, you've alluded to this, is the people dependent on this, especially the politicians. This is their power. This is what they've known their whole lives. Are going to fight not to give it up. And the central bankers are going to fight not to give it up. But it's going to blow up. So the Fed, as we know it, is no longer going to exist. I envision it going back to bankers, real bankers and business people, back to the original role, which is a lender of last resort, and not somebody in the marketplace every day facilitating Wall Street so they can speculate. And I think the big blow up is going to be politically. Now, what's interesting, what you're saying here is my view, I thought around 2009-10, I was getting more optimistic, not thinking about moving money out of the country because of this Tea Party revolution, in that I thought the middle America is revolting. Not the Tea Party per se, but the people in the middle, which is America, which distinguishes America from other countries, is the middle, has woken up and realizes this is unsustainable welfare state, and it's going to explode. It's clear. The math is clear that this is unsustainable and it's going to implode. And they want to do something before it comes to that. So I think, you know, this might work out. Maybe Americans are going to do the right thing here, as opposed to Europe and other countries who are so vested and are so socialistic that they're just going to let it go. Just, you know, they're going to do the grease again. They just let them all fall apart. But now we look like we're going with everybody else. But we're just going to get more and more socialistic until it just blows up. More and more welfare until it just, entitlements until it just blows up. And I do think the model here is the Yale, California. And I remember this very clearly because it blew up in early 2008 before the financial crisis, and everybody knew they were bankrupt. And one of the major publications, and I can't recall if it was the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or whomever, sent a reporter out to talk to the city manager, and they said, you're going bankrupt. And the guy was like, yeah, that's right. Yeah, like his putty on Seinfeld. And the reporter said, well, what are you going to do about it? And he's like, well, what do you want me to do? Well, it's pretty easy, right? You got to rein in spending, and you got to raise some revenue, taxes, sell assets, whatever. And the guy goes, well, I can't do that. And the reporter says, well, why not? Well, if I do that, I'm out of a job, and other politicians will be voted out. Well, what are you going to do? Well, we'll just, you know, let this run its course, and someday a bankruptcy judge will sort this all out. That's what's happening. There is nobody here that's going to stand up and say, oh, let's stop the debt growth. You're going to demonize the other people because you're a threat to their system. You're a threat to their existence. You're a threat to their power. I mean, this is what this is all about. As our founders knew, the bigger the government, the less liberty, the more power. You know, and we know what the whole thing is. But we also know from history, they're going to fight desperately to maintain this social, political, economic system that's been cobbled together for 80 years that's no longer sustainable. This is what's going on now. That's why all the country is so divided. Yeah, there's a reason for that. Because it's clear what's going on and what's going to happen. But the people with the vested interest are not giving it up. The people that eat at the government trough, and that's everybody from the entitlement, people on entitlements, to big business and defense contractors, and the politicians are not giving this up. And that's the problem. I mean, you're right. So now I just think you're going to, like, this thing's going to have to blow up. Now, what's interesting, and where I think the U.S. is at a better advantage than others, is we're not as homogenous as other countries. So you have pockets of this country, and you could call it the blue state, red state, where Texas is doing very well. There are certain areas are doing well. Again, where there's energy, where there's some tech industry, you know, et cetera. So, you know, you look at California. Northern California is talking about seceding because they're still doing well. There's a couple states talking about, part of Colorado, right? They're talking about, let's secede and create our own state. And I think that's, you have certain farm areas, certain other areas where you're getting demographic movement. You know, there's a reason why the SEC is so great in football for a decade. If that's what the demographics are showing, that's where it's going. And so I think that's the one interesting thing in the United States, is if you look at it as a one homogenous entity, you're wrong. I think, much like we say with stocks, you got to look at individual groups and stocks. But I think in the United States, it's the same way. And to give you an idea, I have a fraternity brother of mine who was an executive at a major company, industrial company, Dow company. And they spun off a division that he was president to private equity. And he was here in Illinois. And I just ran into him at a football game recently. And he's moving to Texas because he can't take the higher taxes and the nonsense of Illinois. And, you know, he's moving. That's it. And he's, you know, packing up some of the people that will transfer, others are retiring or looking for their jobs. And the state of Texas, who is highly accommodated, get whatever you want, whatever you need. And he's somewhere around the Dallas area, Fort Worth area, he's taking that division. And of course, he's got the blessing from the private equity people. And that's happening more and more. And we see this in the state of Illinois. You're getting population down, businesses down, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what's happening within the U.S. And of course, you know, people don't want to talk about that. But that is probably one of the redeeming things that we have. You know, if you're in France, there's not a lot of safe places to go. Same thing in Greece, Ireland, Italy, you know, you go through the list. But in the United States, there's still some safe places to go. Canada, to me, looks like a very safe place. The energy, minerals, there's no question. We've always kind of looked at them as being, well, you guys are so much, are kind of a socialist country, and you feed off of us because you don't have to, you know, we take care of your defense spending and on and on. But there's a book out recently, there's a quiet revolution going on in Canada, and I tried to get it, but they won't sell it outside of Canada. And it's because of all this boom in energy out in the western provinces that you've had a lot of immigrants and people coming in from the U.S. and elsewhere, but they're coming into work, they're coming into the energy, and they are turning the political mix of Canada to a little more conservative, more centrist view. So when you look, the Canadian banks were the strongest banks after the crisis in 08 because they didn't play the games with the subprime and they demand higher payments, down payments on housing. Now, their bubble in housing that ensued because Canada was safe, people flocked into Toronto and Vancouver. Well, the Chinese and Asians were pouring into Vancouver. Those two markets have blown up, but you know, they got too hot. But the rest of Canada, there's a transformation. So there's some opportunities there, I think, if you're looking to hide money or have investment money or some other things. But it's hard to find a safe place around the globe. But I think if you look within the U.S. in certain areas, and even into certain areas of Canada, there's some pretty good places to hide.
Well, it is interesting that we're at a point in time, point in history, where that is a part of the conversation, and not here's a place to put money to work and see sort of capital formation. Capitalism is, you know, building on opportunities, and yes, there is an element of creative destruction, but there's less creative and more destruction in the equation today.
Yes.
And so hide is a part of the equation, a part of the must.
Oh, it's the operative word. No, it's not just, it's the operative word right now. Absolutely. It is how to survive what's coming. We know. You look out and you see the weather conditions, right? Whether it's a hurricane, tornado, a major snowstorm. And you know that what that's going to bring. And you don't go, oh, you know what? I'm going to go out and do, no, I'm going to survive this. And then afterwards, we'll worry about what we were going to do here. And I think that's what we've got, a major, major conflagration, storm, whatever coming, and you better survive it. And if you do survive, guess what? You win.
This is the impossible question, and maybe any answer is imprudent, but when you put a time frame to this, it seems like, you know, the old saw, you know, how did you go bankrupt? Well, it was slowly and then all at once.
Yes.
I mean, is this 5 years? Is this 10 years? Is this 24 months? I mean, at an instinctive level.
Yeah. No, and see, again, get back to talking to guys who run these big hedge funds and private equity, everybody would know their names. They don't know, and nobody knows. But you prefaced your question is actually the answer. And is what we know historically is even though these things are obvious, they tend to take longer. Even the start of a bull market, like the gold. I mean, it was obvious that gold was undervalued in the late 90s. in early 2000. It was clear. But it takes longer for these things to develop and hit a critical mass. But when they do, they go very quickly. Now, I was in the gold. One of my first jobs on LaSalle Street was gold in 1975. And they got just absolutely crushed. And then people keep thinking about, oh, God, look at silver in 1979, 1980. Yeah, that's right.
Were you there in 75 and 76?
Well, it was not good. Gold went from 190, after they cut it loose, it went to 195 and it fell down to breached 100 on one day and then it came back above it. But if you go look at the chart, it goes very slowly, just like gold here. You saw gold go up, and then all of a sudden goes to 1900 and blows out. And that's what gold did in silver, especially, because it was obviously more speculative than the gold. With the Hunt brothers back in 79, go look at the chart. That all occurred in a very brief period. And so your point in the preface of your question is, yes, these things take longer to materialize and come to fruition. But when they do, it goes faster than anybody can realize.
Sounds like a little patience is necessary.
Yes, it's a difficult environment. Everybody understands that. I can tell you just from watching people that I've talked to for years, and they're slowly dropping out of business, slowly people losing their jobs. I'm not talking money managers, hedge funds, advisories. This is slow. It's just slowly more and more attrition. And that's telling you, this is speaking very loudly with stocks at all-time highs. That does not compute. Something is seriously wrong. And it is, yeah, only a handful, not even want to say handful, a minuscule amount of people are getting this wealth effect benefit. And the rest are suffering and having a slow degeneration of income and reserves and living standards.
Well, we look forward to continuing the conversation. Hopefully 2014 brings a few rays of sunshine.
Well, it'll be an election year, and it'll be very interesting.
It will. And as always, appreciate your contribution, your thoughts, and look forward to seeing you in Chicago in a few weeks.
Terrific. Sounds good.
Well, as promised, Bill did deliver again. And, you know, I thought it was interesting that he talked about gold, and gold stocks now might actually outperform the S&P 500, because the S&P 500 is getting all of the benefit right now of quantitative easing. Looks like gold might be doing the same thing.
I think it's very important to remember the game that is in play and to be cautious with the way we live our lives, with the way we allocate our assets, and to understand that, as Bill pointed out, there is a threat to power, and that is in play. There is a threat to the status quo, which is no longer sustainable, and the fight that is likely to be witnessed in that context will be nothing short of brutal. And so the notion of having a part of your assets in quiet places, in real things, in things that you control, in things that are in other parts of the world, this becomes very relevant, and perhaps this is what many investors don't realize, is that these are not normal times. And again, you listen to the mass media, and these are beyond normal times. These are improving times. These are times that require you to buy stocks and buy a house and get a rental property and do things that would be a normal investment process or decision-making process in normal times.
Well, and he said, have real things. And you had brought up a great point in the conversation, Dave. That's quiet wealth. But it's also preservation wealth.
And too important to overlook the issue of cash. And this is what's fascinating to me. As often as we move to cash in our managed money portfolios, guess what happens? That cash disappears. People cannot sit in cash. They look at it as a non-investment. They don't see its optionality.
Burns a hole in their pocket.
It must do something with it. Why aren't you doing anything with it? Why don't you invest? That's, I think, one of the most important elements. We've viewed it that way for years now and have increased our cash allocations, decreased our cash allocations, and are now in the process again of doing that same thing again with a focus on cash, with a focus on real things, with a focus on equities that are geared towards a very challenging environment. It's really important that people assume actually the worst. Assume the worst and prepare accordingly. That's the unfortunate state that we find ourselves in today.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest, Bill King. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.